From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. While the novel coronavirus has infected millions of people worldwide and is seen as a great equalizer, a few nations have succeeded far better than most at controlling the virus. New Zealand and South Korea are the two most prominent examples of the COVID-19 success stories. On tomorrow's show, we'll go to New Zealand to see what they did right. Today, we'll examine South Korea and President Moon Jae-in's approach to the COVID-19 pandemic. My guest is Christine Ahn. She's the founder and international coordinator of Women Cross DMZ, a global movement of women mobilizing to end the Korean War. She recently wrote an article titled, South Korea is a model for combating COVID-19. It should now take the lead in diplomacy with North Korea. Welcome to the program, Christine.
Thanks, Sonali.
So first, we know that South Korea had initial problems when it came to the coronavirus. There was a story of the church that was refusing to stop meeting, a super spreader. And South Korea, initially in the early days of the pandemic, looked like it was going to be going the way of China, at least, where there would be this, you know, hard to control outbreak. What changed? What happened? What did President Moon Jae-in do to bring this dramatically under control?
Well, I would say three things. I mean, really, it's testing, testing, and testing. His government swiftly, you know, moved into action, and they did massive nationwide testing. They set up really innovative approaches, such as drive-ins, and where people could pull in and get tested and receive a text message or an email within 6 hours of the status of COVID. They have a nationalized healthcare system, which also included ensuring that each individual had at least two masks per week. What a contrast to this country, where at the beginning of the outbreak, we couldn't find any anywhere. And then I'd say the third thing is the president's reliance on science, you know, in contrast to President Trump conducting the daily briefings. The head of the Korean CDC provided daily briefings, gave up-to-date accounts on the status of the coronavirus, and, you know, gave guidance on what people should do with social distancing. And so I think all of this taken into account, the government's transparent approach in communicating to the citizenry. And then, you know, you couple that with South Korea and the Korean people, just like in most Asian societies, having a very collective-minded approach to ensuring that they collectively work together to combat the pandemic.
So the world's richest country, the U.S., has still not even gotten to the point where we have had enough testing for, say, 2 or 4% of the nation's population. We've been promised week after week that there would be ramped up testing. In fact, of course, our president just has straight out lied to us repeatedly, saying there's plenty of tests available, when in fact we know that there are not. And this, you're saying, is one of the key ways in which South Korea brought the pandemic within its borders under control. If the country, if the United States is not even testing it nearly enough, if South Korea points to testing as a very important tool, then we're doomed.
I know. And I just can't tell you enough that, you know, you look at South Korea and it's mind-boggling. This is a country with 51 million people. It's one of the advanced industrialized economies, I think the 10th largest economy in the world. And they did not have to do a government lockdown like China did. They kept it open. Yes, the schools and most of the major institutions closed, but, you know, it's like my sisters text me, they're going out to dinner to restaurants, and, you know, they have maintained social distancing, everyone wears masks. But what a contrast to how this government is handling this pandemic. And, you know, South Korea's really stepped up. They've sent test kits even to this country and all around the world. And so I think South Korea has really emerged as a model for how to manage this pandemic. And that is why President Moon's party won such a decisive victory in last week's parliamentary elections.
Right, that's right. So they were able to hold an election as well.
Right. They've not only shown the world that you can actually, with a good, strong government, manage this, but you can also hold elections safely. And in fact, this was the largest turnout in like 25 years. And, his party won a landslide victory. And this is so exciting for the peace movement, because it hands President Moon a mandate to pursue what he set out to do, which is pursuing inter-Korean diplomacy. And that is a piece that I wrote with Dr. Ki Park from Harvard Medical School about how President Moon should seize the moment now to advance something that President Trump has also failed in doing, which is achieving peace with North Korea.
And I want to get to that very soon, but just staying on the approaches to the coronavirus pandemic for a minute, how has South Korea managed to keep the virus from returning to the country? Here in the United States, President Trump just banned travel from Europe, banned travel from China, used it as a pretext to temporarily ban green cards, stopped all asylum seeking at the border. They just basically put up the walls. Did South Korea do that, or are people still able to come in and out of the country? And if so, how are they doing it safely?
Well, I mean, that's one thing that I have been really pressing some of the thought leaders here in Hawaii is, you know, we are also similarly to South Korea down to single digits in terms of new cases in the last 10 days. I think there were only 14 cases in Hawaii. And I think the fear is the tourists and the people that come outside of Hawaii. And, you know, there's so many asymptomatic people. And so South Korea has actually done an amazing job. They have basically, once people land at Incheon International Airport, they're sent to kind of like a government hotel, and they're forced to quarantine there for 2 weeks. And
I understand that they're also made to take tests right as they land with temperature checks, and that the test turnaround time is very quick.
Is very quick. I mean, 6 hours. And so they're taking it seriously. And then again, I would say that it's, you know, the collective mindset. I mean, yes, the downside is South Korea has, I think because of their experience with SARS a few years ago, they have really instituted this like pretty intense surveillance system. And I think that's where a lot of the left is very concerned with how the South Korean government is tracking. But also at the same time, I mean, South Korea was voted one of the most democratic countries in the world, which I think is very important in a region like Asia, where there is so much militarization and rising authoritarianism. But that they have managed to do it in a really democratic way, in a way that the public feels that the government is working on in their best interest and communicating with as much detail and with science. And so I think all of these things taken together, it is such a stark contrast to what we're seeing in this country and how the Trump administration has just totally botched any effort to contain this pandemic.
Right. I mean, there seem to be, broadly speaking, two categories that nations have fallen into. One, which is going the authoritarian route, top-down controls, China, Hungary. And then there's the sort of free-for-all disorganized mess, which is what the United States is doing. But then there is that third way that nations like South Korea are showing, that you can have democracy, transparency, science-based medicine, and actually combat the disease perhaps better than either, than even an authoritarian nation could. Because in a situation like this, you need public buy-in, right? You need people to want to wear masks, to observe social distancing. Police can't sit there and police the distance between two people, any given two people at any given time. You need public buy-in. You only get that when you have a respect for democracy.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think you said it perfectly.
So let's talk about what the other upside to what South Korea has managed can be. You wrote about North Korea and diplomacy with North Korea. And of course, a big news coming out of North Korea these days is, where is Kim Jong-un? And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on that. There was rumors that he fell into a coma and hasn't revived. And then other rumors saying that he was out of the country trying to avoid catching the disease. And North Korea has claimed that they have zero cases of COVID-19.
I mean, let me just first address the issue about North Korea and COVID-19. I mean, you know, North Korea is unlikely to communicate whether they have COVID-19 or not, because if they do, then I think that they feel very subject and vulnerable to being constantly at the threat of a U.S. first strike. So, you know, I'm not saying that that's the right approach for North Korea, but I would say that's probably undergirds a lot of the reason why they try to detract from, confirming cases. As to Kim Jong-un, let's just start with, where did the source come from? It came from an anonymous source from a South Korean news site run largely by North Korean defectors called NK Daily. And then CNN basically blew it up. And it's incredible to me how just after 17 days of Kim Jong-un's absence, he has been absent for like up to 41 days. There has been mass hysteria that he's dead or this or that. Well, Moon Jong-in, who is President Moon in South Korea, senior envoy in North Korea, you know, tried to put it to rest. He said, based on our intelligence, Kim Jong-un is alive and he is well. But that has not stopped the rumor mill, the echo chamber that just continues. I think there were 400,000 tweets that Kim Jong-un is dead. And, you know, our concern is that this just, just falls into this collapsism framework that has, you know, shaped and undergird U.S. policy for the last 70 years. And if anybody who has studied the North Korean system and the regime, we know that this government has made every effort to prepare for any kind of disaster, from U.S. first strike regime change to what they experienced during the famine in the 1990s. So we don't know entirely what is happening to Kim Jong-un, but I think it's safe to say that we should trust the South Korean sources when they say that he is alive and well, and that we should actually redirect the conversation to how can we actually have a diplomatic relationship, so that we don't just depend on satellite images of a train in Wonsan that is, you know, where Kim Jong-un is. Wouldn't it be better to actually have a relationship? And if we are so concerned about the conditions in North Korea and the fate of the North Korean people, the best thing we can do is actually make peace. We can end the 70-year war with North Korea.
And President Trump had promised that he was making peace with North Korea, at least between the U.S. and North Korea, maybe jumping on the bandwagon after South Korean President Moon Jae-in had sort of paved the way. Nothing really seems to have come of that in the end. I mean, you and I talked many times over the course of the past several years about the progress that was being made, regardless of our opinion of Trump and Trumpism. That was a potential bright spot with the Trump administration trying to go further toward peace with North Korea than any Democratic president in recent years had certainly done, Obama. But what came of it?
Well, I think you're right. I think the right thing that Trump did was to meet with Kim Jong-un. I think the Singapore Declaration was the right approach, a commitment to transforming 70 years of war into normalized relations with North Korea. But the problem is the Trump administration's approach has been, on the one hand, Trump having this personal relationship with Kim and expecting that that's going to resolve 70 years of war. When on the other hand, the US has been waging a very brutal, draconian maximum pressure campaign, which has included intensifying sanctions against that country. It has included diplomatic isolation of that country, and has also included military exercises with South Korea. And so I think the important takeaway is that the stalled progress between the U.S. and North Korea is not just impacting the security of Americans or North Korean people, but it's also greatly delaying progress between North and South Korea. So Moon Jae-in, who has been kind of the key interlocutor between the U.S. and North Korea, but also in really, you know, extending an olive branch to North Korea. And what is hopeful to me in this moment is that Moon Jae-in has announced that they're going to take small steps. April 27th was the second year anniversary of that, you know, like world-watched Panmunjom meeting at the DMZ between Kim and Moon. And he had said at his two-year anniversary speech that they are going to proceed. They're going to take small steps. And one thing that they're going to do is to try to link the inter-Korean railroad that had been stalled. And guess who had put the kibosh on that? It was the U.S. under the guise of the UN command, saying that that would be a violation of sanctions. They put up all this red tape preventing the two Koreas. And in, I think it was in October of 2018, after, you know, two summits, two declarations were signed, the two Koreas began the process of demilitarizing the joint security area, demining portions of the DMZ. You know, Pompeo basically put in a call to Foreign Minister Kang Kyung-hwa from South Korea and said, hey, 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 wait a minute, you guys are moving way too fast. And unfortunately, that followed by the collapse of talks in Hanoi, thanks to John Bolton, we have been in a serious impasse. And so the bright spot is, this is the 70th anniversary of the Korean War. I think Korean people on the peninsula and around the world feel the urgency to end this war that has had devastating consequences, not just for the North Korean people who live on a day-to-day against sanctions, such as North Korean women whose livelihoods have been destroyed by these sectoral sanctions that target so many industries in which they work, but think about the thousands, tens of thousands of Korean families and the elders who yet are, you know, waiting in line to see their loved ones in North Korea. And I think this pandemic and the swift response by South Korea and the model that it has exhibited to the world shows that right now, this is the opportunity for North and South Korea to start to collaborate and to move this peace process forward, because certainly we are not waiting on the Trump administration.
Is there an opening for coronavirus diplomacy, if you will, if North Korea is likely to be struggling with the virus, even though it is a closed society, it's hard for travelers to come in, but it's also a society that has been decimated by decades of sanctions. It's a poor, incredibly poor society. South Korea, you mentioned, has helped to send supplies here to the United States. Is it making similar offers to North Korea? And can, you know, sanctions be eased around medical supplies?
Yeah, and I think that's the piece that I wrote with Dr. Park, is that the global context has changed dramatically with this pandemic. And one is the call for a global ceasefire put forth by Secretary General of the UN, Antonio Guterres. And, you know, the US and South Korea agreed to cancel the joint military exercises this spring. I think that President Moon can take it a step further and say, we are calling off the military exercises permanently until we resolve while we are in this peace process. And the other thing is, I think the global call for lifting sanctions, especially those that are impeding humanitarian aid. We know Michelle Bachelet, the head of the Human Rights Commission of the UN, also issued a call, her concern. And, you know, thankfully, we're seeing some movement towards that end. But, you know, I think the thing that will really help improve the situation and help North and South Korea in its peace process is the U.S. taking a stand, taking a different approach than the maximum pressure campaign. And, you know, I hope that as we move towards, you know, more debate in this country over the presidential election, that we see some shift from the Biden campaign. My concern is that we're going to return back to the Hillary Clinton style, Barack Obama, you know, strategic patience. We are holier than thou and unwilling to engage with the North Korean regime. And, you know, even the UN Special Rapporteur on North Korea Human Rights, Thomas Quintana, recently said that he urges the United States to negotiate a peace agreement with North Korea separate from a denuclearization deal, because that is the path to improving human rights in North Korea. So I think that there is a new consensus, it's a new day, and you know, the United States, and especially the Democratic Party, must come along with this new reality.
Finally, Christine, I want to just turn back to South Korea and its approach to coronavirus. One of the things, as we mentioned, was that South Korea has provided COVID tests to the United States. So specifically, the governor of Maryland and his wife, who is of Korean origin, helped to procure 500,000 tests from South Korea, which is the kind of test I'm imagining South Korea has used very successfully to track and limit the spread of its disease. However, the state of Maryland has not been able to use those tests yet because the Federal Drug Administration, the FDA, has refused to validate them, refused to approve them as of yet. I mean, this is just kind of unbelievable because, of course, the Trump administration tends to function more on pride than on actual science.
I know. I mean, even Trump, I think, tweeted something about or said at a press conference recently that he got a call from Moon Jae-in congratulating him for his handling of COVID and the massive testing. I mean, what a joke. Mm-hmm. I'm sure President Moon is very diplomatic with President Trump and has always constantly like positively encouraging him on. But, you know, I think it's time for South Korea to take the lead and for us to support that government, who has managed so swiftly and effectively the coronavirus pandemic. And now it's time for us to allow South Korea to take the lead. Right. In pursuing rapprochement with North Korea.
And it would be great for the U.S. media to sort of put away their notions of American exceptionalism and point to South Korea and other nations like it. We'll be covering New Zealand on our show tomorrow to see how those nations have led the way, respected democracy, and in fact exercised great democracy while combating the virus. Christine, thank you so much for joining us today. We'll post a link to the article that you co-wrote from our website and share it with our audience.
Thank you so much, Sonali.
My guest has been Christine Ahn, founder and international coordinator of Women Cross DMZ, a global movement of women mobilizing to end the Korean War. She recently wrote an article titled, South Korea is a Model for Combating COVID-19. It should now take the lead in diplomacy with North Korea. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.